If you want to support this podcast and get a full ad-free episode, sign up to Headstuff Plus.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This show is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Headstuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.
When is the right age for kids to go online?
How much screen time is too much?
What the hell are kids watching online these days?
This is For Tech's Sake, a co-production from Silicon Republic and the Headstuff Podcast Network. We're your hosts, Jenny Darmody
and Elaine Burke. And today, me and Jenny, two childless wagons, are going to tell you how to raise your kids.
Yep.
Because we know everything. We're so wise.
That's what's happening today.
We know parenting back to front with our absolutely zero experience.
Yeah. We're here to tell you how to raise your kids. I would like to think of myself as a very excellent auntie and godmother, though.
Oh, so, and a godmother. I'm a godmother too.
Yeah. So, you know, we know some stuff. We know some kids.
Yeah, the godmother. Yeah. And like, you know, I love other people's kids. Big fan of having them come over and have the crack, and then I can hand them back and have none of the responsibility.
Yeah.
Because I would not enjoy that. I think parents like have it pretty hard these days. I'm kind of like relieved that I'm not one.
It terrifies me. So a lot of the kids that are in my life, I have friends who have kids, I have nieces, and I've got a daughter and stuff, and they're all like below or near 10, like at max. And particularly my friends' kids are quite young. And what they have all noticed, the parents have noticed, that when the children are around me and they're kind of minding their own business and exploring the world around them, these are 2-3-year-olds, and they're doing something that looks dangerous to me, I am literally on my nerves, and the parents are rolling around the place laughing because they're like, he'll be fine. And then they kids, they smell the fear and they do it more because they know they're getting a laugh out of their parents at me, at my
expense. Your expense.
So that's without even bringing in the whole conversation of technology, because these are young kids that are far like away from the technology so far, mostly. But like, I can't even, like, if I can't watch a child like crawl across a bench that's like half an inch off the floor without worrying, oh my God, he's going to fall off and crack his skull, I don't know how I would navigate the whole world of, no, you may not go on TikTok ever for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I have such similar anxieties. Like, I'm walking down the street and I see, you know, a pointy railing, and I'm like, well, I could trip on that railing. It could impale me through my eyeball and then I'd be dead. So that's the line of thinking that I have. That's why I don't have kids. I have too much anxiety. And I'm not too bad when the parents are in the room. But yeah, if I'm responsible for the kids and they're doing anything that looks slightly dangerous, I am a bit, ooh. But I do know a lot of, not only people who have kids and who are great carers of kids, but also some people who work with like childhood education and stuff like that. And I'm aware of these schools that are kind of all about, I think they're more preschooled, but they're all really about like outdoor play and risky play. And that's actually really important for kids' development to engage in risky play. Because when you think about when we were kids, you know, having scratched elbows was pretty much your outfit.
Like,
wasn't a day in my young life that there wasn't some sort of a wound on me, I don't think. And that was all part of like risky play and learning, you know, your capabilities, or in my case, lack of abilities when it comes to not being clumsy and falling off of things. I think that stuff is still important, but these days, unfortunately, there is a kind of move away of a lot of physical play. There's a lot more digital play and stuff like that. And like, again, gaming is, I'm not trying to demonize that. Like, gaming's super fun. We did gaming. Like, you're a much bigger gamer than I am even now. And like, there's lots to be gained from that. It's entertaining, it's fun, and like, it can be educational, but also it can also just be a bit of crack. And like, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But I do wonder about the media diet of kids these days. Like the game and stuff, I don't have so much of an issue with. I think people have gone over the like video games are
violence and bad and terrible things.
To be demonized and all that. But like, just like the media stuff, I do actually get a bit like, the kids today, what are they watching?
You mean like what they're watching on YouTube and stuff?
Yeah. Like if they're watching Bluey, I'm like, yes, absolutely. Like, watch Bluey all day, every day. What an amazing show. But like then when they're on YouTube, when they're watching someone open up toys for hours on end.
Like an unboxing.
Yeah. And like the slimes, like just playing with slimes and stuff like that. And like, right, okay, I understand the oddly satisfying corner of the internet. I am a frequenter of it myself. I love all that ASMR stuff. I you know, in particular flavours would be my taste, but you know, I get it. But then the part that really throws me is the kids that spend hours upon hours watching someone else play a video game. Like, I saw a tweet describe it so perfectly as like, kids today are entertained by doing the thing that we were forced to do every Christmas, which was like watching your cousin play the game that you really wanted to be playing. And you just had to be like, when do I get my turn to be Mario? That's what they're into. I don't get it.
So is this a safe space?
Yes. Do you watch gaming videos?
I'm a woman in my 30s and I do. Well, so I watch reacty videos. Now, it depends. Maybe you're going to tell me I'm wrong, but are these just people silently playing games, or are these like
they're talking through it, they're kind of saying what they're doing, and you know, to be fair, like I know from some of my nieces and nephews watching them that they're also like playing a level that they're struggling with and they're seeing how to get through it, or say it's Minecraft and they're building a thing and they're trying to learn how to build it, but sometimes they're just playing the game and talking over it.
Yeah that's fair. So I don't know, just because I've done it and do it, like my YouTube algorithm is awash with react videos. Now it's more like movies or shows or something, and that will be stuff I've seen mostly, but also sometimes it's games that I've played that I want to see a first time reactor to, because it's like a big game, like, and it's story led or whatever, and it's like watching a movie. But then other ones, sometimes I just want to experience it and I know I'm never going to play it. So it could be a console I don't have access to, or it's a scary game that I'm never going to play. Because if that game relies on me walking through that door to get jump scared, let me tell you something, that character is going to stand there for 4 hours. So sometimes I just need someone to do it for me.
I'm laughing so hard because I just realised how much similar you are to our common friend who can't watch anything that has suspense in it and just reads Wikipedia summaries of every film.
Yeah, so it's why I understand her so much, because I don't read the Wikipedia page, but I will sometimes watch someone else watch it for me.
And you know what? You've educated me here, because I am that person who likes that kind of rich media experience that we get now. So like, I literally come out of the cinema after watching Barbie and I'm looking up like quizzes of Barbie and behind the scenes stuff about Barbie and how did they make this film? And like, when I watch TV shows now, I love a React podcast, because some of the TV shows I'm watching, no one else is watching along with me anymore. So just to have the idea that I'm having a conversation about it is my way of like reaching that is true to like listening to podcasts about it. So I get it now. You've taught me something here today. I understand the children now.
There you go. I helped you understand the kids, because I am one. But it is mad how much children are kind of online, because this is me as a grown ass woman, because I wasn't on YouTube when I was 8, because my first phone I got as a confirmation present.
Did YouTube exist when you were 8? Are you that young?
Probably not. When was YouTube? I don't know how old YouTube was then.
I don't know.
Like showing my age. But my first phone wasn't a smartphone, obviously. It was a Nokia 3410. So this stuff wasn't really on the radar. The phone thing of like giving a child a phone was like, you have this responsibility. Now you can text people and call us if you're in trouble. And that was like the extent of it. But now, there's some stats I have from CyberSafe Kids. Their latest annual report will be released by the time this podcast is dropped. So boo timing.
Yeah, that didn't work out for us.
But some of the stats in their previous report were released around this time last year, and it says 95% of 8 to 12 year olds own their own smart device.
I was expecting a high number, but that's nearly total penetration.
Yeah.
What? that's a lot.
To flip that, like 5% of 8 to 12 year olds don't have a smartphone device. Like, just when you think about it like that. And then 87% of 8 to 12 year olds have their own social media or instant messaging accounts.
That's also a lot higher than I was expecting. Like, again, I wasn't expecting it to be low, but
Nearly 90%.
Yeah, it's getting into the 90 figures there. That's a lot of kids online.
That's a lot of kids online.
I'm starting to think about the things that I'm putting out online and what kids might be seeing that I've put out there.
Yeah. And then when in terms of like the apps, unsurprisingly, as we just talked about, YouTube is the most popular app at 78%, followed by TikTok at 47%. So there's a big jump there. Like YouTube is definitely by far the most popular, but TikTok 47%, Snapchat 41%, and WhatsApp 40%. So if children were posting videos of themselves online, they'd be more likely to do so on TikTok, which is interesting. They watch YouTube, but they post to TikTok.
Right, yeah. YouTube has nearly become like TV.
TV.
Like being a YouTube star is like being a TV star in a lot of, like as a comparison, like we would have thought being on TV was being a star, but I think kids today think being on YouTube is being a star.
Which is interesting because when TV stars were the TV stars, YouTube was like anyone can blog on YouTube.
Yeah.
And now YouTube is the stars and TikTok is the amateur place, maybe.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
It is also interesting, but like I'm still kind of caught up in that, like, you know, what content am I putting out there and is it suitable for possible 8 to 12 year olds to be reading it? Now I do, I actually do have a WhatsApp group that has some of my nieces and nephews in it. I don't think any of them are under 13, and then you know a couple of them would be on Instagram and follow me there. But like, it's not like us as adults, and I'm talking about us as just completely like, you know, being normal everyday adults, not trying to create inappropriate content for kids intentionally or anything like that.
Or content for kids, full stop.
But that's what I mean. Like, we're just putting things online, thinking of this as an adult space, but like, it's making me realize actually how much the internet really isn't an adult space. And like, I don't think the platform makers are too happy about that. Like, that's probably the wrong way of putting it. But like, from what I've heard from people who work in trust and safety, and that they're the teams that are responsible of trying to kind of like keep kids out of inappropriate spaces online. So a lot of like social media apps set the barrier at 13 and up. And it just seems to be that they don't want to deal with under 13s because that just seems to be, you know, definitively kids.
Yeah.
And comes with extra responsibilities that they can get into trouble for if there's missteps and stuff like that. So they would rather wash their hands of that. And the way that they do wash their hands of that is they just set off, you know, in their guidelines or whatever, it's for age 13 and up, and when you sign up you have to set a year or something like that or give your birth date, and that's a very very easy thing to work around. But when you do that, what actually happens is, like, say if a kid signs up, fakes their birth date, and that's how they get through the barrier, like, and that's very easily done, there's signals then that their usage might send to the algorithms on that platform that will actually indicate that they are a child using an adult account.
Yeah. Yeah,
because sometimes there's kids safe accounts that they can't use or whatever, but they have systems to be able to. Now, it wouldn't be 100% effective like all algorithms and all these systems, but they do some work to, you know, weeding out the accounts that are faking it. But what I also have been told is that what also happens a lot of the time is that the parent's own account is actually what's used by the kid. So then that has a mixed use. So there's a parent using a TikTok account, and then there's a kid who sometimes uses their phone and accesses TikTok through the parent's account. That won't give such definitive signals that account can get kicked off then, because it'll be a mixed use of the parent's activity and the kid's activity. So like, that's a real challenge for them. Like, and there's nothing they can do about what parents do with their own kids.
Yeah, and it's difficult because I would imagine that a lot of parents who might do that, you know, might lend their phone to their child sometimes, is to give them a little bit of what they want without giving them a device, because I feel like that's the barrier that parents are trying to avoid. When should I give my child a smartphone? I don't want to give them a smartphone. I won't be able to see what they're doing all the time. You're not ready for a smartphone. You're too young for a smartphone. But then the constant pestering of like that, be like, okay, like, you can borrow mine to have a look at it. I'll be able to see what you're doing. I'm going to take it back off you. It's my phone. All these things in their head sound like controls, but what you just said counteracts that completely, because they now have access to an unfiltered adult phone that doesn't have any, you know, limits on it, any parental restrictions, a child safe account on it or anything like that.
But I think it's a good point now to talk to an expert.
Yes.
Don't you?
I agree.
So our expert today is Dr. Coleman Nochter, who is a child and adolescent psychotherapist with a keen interest in the effects of contemporary media on child development and mental health. So he's ideal for this conversation. You've probably already heard him on the radio or read his column in the Irish Examiner on these topics. And he recently wrote a book called The 4-7 Zone, which has a chapter on managing your technological diet. welcome, Colman. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
It's great to talk to you. I've been aware of your work for such a long time, and it's just, it's something that comes up so often. I think there's a lot of anxieties around children and technology, and it's great to have an expert voice contributing to this. We don't even have kids, let alone the qualifications that you have here. But something that's interesting that I've seen from your work is you've written that there is no straight answer to those common questions, which is, what's the age that kids should have smartphones, and how much screen time is too much screen time? Like, it's not a very black and white issue. So tell us your thoughts there.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you work in this area for as long as I do, you know that maturity levels vary. So age is a most unreliable indicator of, you know, 13-year-olds who you might have no issues around their use of technology. They seem to have a lot of common sense. They're sensible. There's 17-year-olds who would have grave concerns around their choices around their digital communication. And so the idea of, I think you assess it on the basis of the child rather than on their age. And I think from the point of view of, we have a kind of an urban myth that 13 seems to be the age, in terms of most of the platforms would have that age, but almost like your confirmation, you know, you book the suit by the phone, you know, there's that sort of an idea to it, or in some cases in the communion. And again, I would think that varies very much from child to child. I think people who are sensible offline or sensible online, and so it's a most reliable indicator is your temperament, the maturity level, and the wisdom of your child, and that would, it's at that point you can choose whether they are ready or not. I have three children myself. My eldest is 13. He's just got his phone. He'd no interest in getting it. He's an Xbox, and he's much more interested in that. His sister, he's 10 and will take her left hand off for her phone. And she is one I'd be far more cautious about giving it to, because her enthusiasm comes with a naivety as well. So these are all these kind of variables that you would kind of think about in terms of what age a child should get a phone. The second thing is, I don't believe screen time to be a reasonable dashboard either. And I'll explain why I think that is. I think there's time spent and time well spent on technology. And technology for me is a bit like food. You have good foods and not so good foods. And, you know, it's not about living a donut-free life. You know, we all had to have those Candy Crush moments and everything else, but you don't, if you're having donuts for every meal, then you're going to come into difficulties. And so for me, it's, you know, we don't judge a child's diet by how much time they sit eating at a table. We judge it by the content that they consume. And so from that point of view, the idea of technology is, you know, I can spend an hour on YouTube learning a song on a guitar, and that's a good use of my time. It's a tutorial and I'm coming away with a skill. Or I can spend an hour on another platform looking at pictures of my ex and where she is in her life now, and come away speaking very badly of myself and my own decisions. So the screen time would say an hour each, but the things that I've done in that hour on the screen are very, very different. And so the move away from the time spent to time well spent is about maybe us teaching ourselves to use our time better. It's the way in which we choose to kind of say, well, I've had a bit more donuts today than I need, and I might, you know, have less this evening, or I might, and we self-regulate. The issue with children is that they haven't the neurological capacity to self-regulate. So the responsibility of technological use is in the hand of the user, and it is a fairly unregulated platform. So my view is always that, you know, you work with the user rather than technology, because they're the ones that have the influence over making those choices. But for children, I think they haven't developed that skill, and then we give out to them for not being regulated on their use of technology, when in actual fact that's something they're unable to do rather than unwilling to do. And I think that puts them in an unfair position.
And presumably there's no age that dictates when you suddenly are able to self-regulate, and there's probably some adults who still struggle with that as well. Is there a way as a parent to maybe assess where your child is at in that kind of way?
Again, it's maybe their ability to step back from something. And our self-regulation will be different. You know, some people who don't have a sweet tooth, you know, having a packet of Penguin bars in the cupboard is not an issue. Whereas for those of us who do, that's much more of a difficulty. So it's about your own kind of vulnerability to the stimulus, if that makes any sense. And when I did my PhD, I looked at online sharing and why do we do that. And so what I did was I set up a a Facebook profile at the time. I wouldn't be doing that now, but and I recruited kind of people and I looked at their sharing patterns and I interviewed the four most prolific sharers and asked them, you know, what was the experience? Why did you do it? And what was the feeling afterwards? And what I found was most people were looking to find themselves rather than announce themselves. You know what I mean? So the idea of how important it was to be on your phone or to have your phone with you or to post your blueberry muffin or whatever it was that you're doing, that's a very individual concept. And so self-regulation will be more difficult for people who have a real leniency or vulnerability to need to know versus those who aren't. And you'll notice people who go, oh, I forgot my phone today, and then they're grand, whereas other people are getting six buses back to the house to pick it up, you know. And it's again, I think our relationship with technology is an emotional one. I think it's an extension of our lives. And so, you know, they're not just a device that allows you to call someone or phone someone. It's about, we put our pictures in there, we put our diaries in there, we put our dream logs in there. And it's like, you know, a copybook ceases to be a copybook when it becomes a diary. And so the technology is, it's how much we invest in it will create that intensity of that relationship with it, which will in turn intensify whether self-regulation is more difficult or not. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, 100%.
Absolutely. And you talked about, like, you know, the quality of the time spent on it rather than the amount of time and stuff. And I think there's a lot of talk about, you know, the negative impacts of technology on kids and just kind of flat out. But like, is there like really strong research around the fact that it absolutely is negative, or are there positive aspects to it too?
And there's a research only recently that said, you know, in terms of gaming is very good for children in terms of cognitive alertness, sharpness, astuteness, decision making, that sort of stuff. And again, technology is not good or bad. The usage is, you know. And so from the point of view of, you know, we can see how technology has been used to, you know, rescue from someone from the side of a mountain with a drone or something, and it can also get you scammed by some prince in some African country who needs to send money to. So from the point of view of that, there are two uses of technology that are very different. But so I don't think you can say good or bad. I just think good or bad usage. But we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's a lot of really helpful ways in which technology can enhance young people. And I work lots of young people with dyslexia. I have issues with young people with dyspraxia who'd have difficulty, you know, organizing things. And the introduction of assistive technology has been hugely important for them. It's been a game changer for children with autism in terms of their abilities, you know, going from picture boards to iPads, things like that. So it's not about good or bad. It's about good or bad usage. And again, that comes down to our personal choice. But I think our relationship with technology is still so recent. You know, the idea that like the iPhone baby is only 15 this year. So from the point of view of that was a game changer in terms of the handheld technology was different to the PC in the corner of the sitting room. You know, so from the point of view of it's still our relationship with that technology is still in its adolescence, if that makes any sense, because we're still trying to work that out. And I would hope that it gets better as we mature with it. But I still think we're quite romanticized by technology. We're still in wonder about what it can do. And sometimes that leaves us a little bit naive to what it can do. But my hope would be that it gets better rather than more and more naive. And anyway, the advent of AI and all that sort of stuff is going to be really interesting. You know, I work in a university, so ChatGPT and all those sort of things have become challenges that we have to think around and all of that sort of stuff. But again, it'll take time for us to settle with it. And we have to give children time as well. I think, you know, handing a child a device that's a portal to the outside world when they're 8, I hope at some point we'll see, maybe time will show us that that probably wasn't the best thing to do. And as we become more informed, we make better choices, I hope.
And then looking at the technology makers and their part in this as well, like the impression I get is that they would rather not be dealing with under 13s on their platforms because it just causes a lot of headaches for them. So that's why they put the advisory out there that the platforms are for 13 and over. And we've already kind of talked about how, you know, that doesn't really set a great guideline because a 13-year-old and up could have bad self-regulation and have bad experiences there. But it does seem to be that they're genuinely interested in, or not interested in, babysitting kids, and they are trying to make an internet that's maybe for 13 and up in the majority of spaces. But it's so hard, it's so easy to bypass. Like, it is just a case of, like, if you're smart enough as a kid to just put in the wrong year for your date of birth or something like that. Like, is there any point to this other than just technology makers are just trying to give themselves some leeway in saying, we didn't build the platform for under 13. So if they're having bad experiences on it, it's not really our fault.
Yeah, I think it's a bit like, you know, we provide the platform in the village for people to come up and talk. What they say is up to them. You know, I think there's it goes a little bit more than that. And again, I think technology companies is a very generic term as well. There might be some who are a bit more outreachy and concerted efforts to make difference than ones that are a bit more sinister and that. So I think it depends very much on the platform. Some of the outreach stuff I would view as very tokenistic and have very little weight when you don't increase robustness of age verification. Really, is anything that you say difficult? You know, but for me, the internet's unregulatable is its secret sauce. You know, that's the issue that makes it most attractive. You take that out, and there's lots of people have started up these kind of walled garden social networks for small children. They don't take off because they're not an adult-free space. You know, the idea of the attraction of it is its unregulatable nature of it. So the idea of you kind of lose that if you bring that in. And so I think technology companies are very aware of that. But there is a lot of headaches for the under 13s who are accessing things and, you know, maybe causing issues for them. But I do believe that, like, I think technology companies have a great deal of foresight. And I use the example of, like, I talk to my colleagues about metaverse and, you know, that sort of stuff. And people are saying, avatars is like, and I'm saying, it's not for us. That's for my kids who are using avatars in their Fortnite and everything else for the last 5 years. They're going to grow up in that. So it's they're in training for that, which is coming next. And it's not for me in my mid-40s to go, I don't want to be a cartoon. You know what I mean? So from the point of view of, I think there's, they have made very little mistakes. You know, I can remember in a class in 1999 and, you know, a friend was explaining texting. And I was like, that'll never take off. You know, why would you just not call? You know, they knew something that we didn't know. And then the idea of video, who's going to do that? You know, lo and behold, I stand corrected again. And they haven't got a lot wrong in terms of how they've anticipated things. And I don't think they do anything naively. So if it was better for them to not allow them on there under 13 and they could do it, I think they would. So while there are headaches involved, I think there's some benefits involved too, you know.
To kind of secure their future with these users. That's us told. Like, we're going to be that person there in a few years who said, people, oh, that metaverse, that's never going to take off. And all the kids today will be like, these old wagons. don't know what they're talking about.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it is. Like, I see my kids and everything in their Snapchat and everything is avatars and picking my hair colour and my eye colour and my da, 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 da. And they communicate through those issues. So the thoughts of me sending my avatar to a conference in Turkey on child psychiatry sounds bizarre, but to them, that might not be. They'll put their VR headset and say, yeah, let's go. Let's do it, you know.
And I think parents always ask the question that we talked about at the start, which is like, you know, what age is okay? Because they just want the definitive answer and they can't really get that because, as you said, it is child dependent. But, you know, do they need to start having the conversation about what the online space is like maybe earlier so that they can prepare themselves? Like you said, like, some might be a little bit more resilient towards the overload. Would conversations around that help them better?
Yeah, and I think it's like a language that you need to teach. You know, you're learning, you know, we did safe cross codes and we were growing up about how to cross a road and, you know, how to negotiate things like that, stranger danger, all that sort of stuff. It's similar, but it's just in a whole different level, you know, in terms of trying to maintain that level of digital savvy. And it will, you know, you can teach safe cross code to a kid 100 times, they still leg it across without looking, you know. So from the point of view, these are not foolproof
methods. I'm still that kid.
Jaywalking. But from the point of view, the issue around, because it's so pervasive, it needs a far more involved in our fabric of our learning than it does now. It can't be just a class at the end or a policeman comes in and tells us about cyber safety once a year. That's nowhere near enough, I think, in terms of that. So our digital literacy and I do think it has, because I said that technology is an emotional issue, I think it has to be thought in that way. The emotional dynamic of what it's like to get likes and how that affects our dopamine levels and how it makes us excited and how disappointing it is when someone doesn't open our Snapchat message and how we're left unread or whatever. Like, those sorts of things are hugely significant in negotiating the digital world from an emotional point of view. Like, it's not just about, we don't teach children to negotiate the world by crossing roads. You know, we teach them how to learn with disappointment, how to deal with failure, how to deal with being hoodwinked. You know, if something's too good to be true, it could be, that sort of stuff. And I think that's the level we need to pitch our digital and emotional literacy too, because I don't believe it to be simply, it's not like driving a car. Well, I suppose in some ways it is, but you know, you can say don't drink, don't speed, blah, blah, blah. But you know, you have to understand that you're in charge of a big machine here that could hurt somebody, could hurt somebody else. You have to take that seriously. There's a responsibility. And I would always say being online and having access is a responsibility. It's not a human right. Do you know what I mean? And you earn the right by showing the responsibility. And that's why I would love to see a kind of a driving test equivalent to children eventually about how you would earn the maturity to be able to be on that space.
Like a license to go online.
Yeah, pretty much. And I think it would be an emotional assessment as much as, you know, what would you do if blah, 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 blah. And you know, we think if we develop children's technological skills, we keep them safe. In actual fact, the research would say the opposite. You know, they're more likely to fumble into places that they shouldn't be because they can negotiate passwords or whatever the case may be. And it's interesting that the children of tech-informed parents are much more cautious about their children's use of technology than parents who aren't informed. So the idea that, you know, knowledge is power is in terms of when it comes to now helping your children to develop that literacy. Do you know what I mean? So those parents aren't teaching them how to navigate the infrastructure. They're teaching them how to pace their introduction to it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's difficult because I feel like there's adults that could do with the license to go online, that emotional, like I feel like as adults, we're teaching ourselves the effects that social media has on us as grown-up people. So to navigate that as a learning for children.
And I think the idea of kids and their screens is hugely unhelpful because it's timeless. Like some of the most immature use of technology I've ever seen have come from 40-year-olds. Yeah. Just being, so from the point of view of...
I was in the cinema last night and people were taking pictures during the film with flash on. Like, what the actual fuck?
Do you know what I mean? Like the idea of... It's too handy to say this is all kids, you know, the issue around...
And too much screen time is a really common...
And that's the idea that I believe that we have, as a society, we've moved hugely into emotional expression. Tell us how you feel, you know, have feelings and you know, boys cry, all that sort of stuff. That's a really good message. But it has to be accompanied by emotional intelligence, which is about being aware of that. If you have emotional expression without emotional intelligence, you kind of have Twitter in some respects where people are shouting, I have feelings, but they're not really processing those feelings. And so the idea around it's not just about being able to express emotion, it's about understanding it, you know. And, you know, I know we're making big strides in terms of well-being and all that sort of stuff, but I do think, and I think perhaps COVID hasn't helped in terms of the social and emotional development of people over the last number of years, but there again, that emotional component of tech needs to be included. You know, I think it's a social dynamic, and when anything that involves human interaction will involve emotion, it'll involve manipulation, it'll involve reaction, and we have to kind of teach ourselves how to manage that reaction.
We are pausing for a moment to remind you that we are part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network. And yes, we know you're told that at the beginning and end of every episode, but maybe you're thinking to yourself, what does that mean?
Well, it means that we are part of a family of podcasts, which includes Agony Rants, Basically, Double Love, Fireside, Sissy That Pod, and so many more.
And it means you can support us by becoming a Head Stuff Plus community member, and it will only cost you a bit more than a fiver per month.
Yes, that means you get access to members-only content, not just from us, but from all of the shows that we mentioned across the network.
Very generous.
Very generous indeed. And Headstuff is so generous that they are actually opening up the studios right here where we are recording for Culture Night this month.
That's so exciting. And here's more information.
Here at the podcast studios, we're opening our doors to everyone this Culture Night. Come see the place where your favourite Headstuff shows are made. Get behind the scenes access, learn about production and record your very own 5-minute podcast. This is an opportunity not to be missed. Join us on Friday, 22nd of September. Register on eventbrite.ie or see the Culture Night website for details. We look forward to seeing you there.
But it was really good to see that community in Greystones where the parents actually banded together as a collective and said, none of the kids are getting phones until secondary school. We've all agreed together that that's what's going to happen. And I'm sure that helped to take some of that pressure off because they kind of took away the keeping up with the Joneses sort of aspect of it.
Yeah, I think 90% of parents give a device to their child with trepidation. And they say, this is against my better judgment, but you can have it. And it's the pester power that creates that need to give it. And what unfortunately, when it, the way it works now is that the lowest common denominator or the weakest link in the chain or the first parent to break sets the tone for everyone else. So if you get Call of Duty over 18s game in fifth class, then you put on the pressure on all the other parents to follow suit. And that's what happens, is they say, well, Elaine has it. And, oh, well, if Elaine has it, you can have it. You know, that sort of stuff. And so the idea that we are not determined by evidence-informed decision-making, we're informed by pressure. And the difference in that is that one of the biggest challenges of being a parent is giving your child what they need, not what they want. And your child wants this phone, but they need not to have it. And the pressure of, I will be a social outcast if I don't have this, and no one will like me, and I won't be able to chat to my friends. You don't want to be the one responsible for your child becoming a social outcast. So you do give it against your better judgment, or whatever the case may be. So when you have something like the Greystones Initiative, it takes that pressure off. It allows people to go, well, if no one in the class is getting, well, then I'm not going to be under that pressure. And that is phenomenally impressive, but it's in pockets. You know, it'll happen in these certain areas, but it would be very, very difficult to roll that out across the board. I think there's the pressures there already, you know, and you'll have cousins who don't live in Greystones who have phones and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. But the issue around that idea of giving people what they want and what they need, I think there's another interesting dynamic, and I was only thinking about this driving in. The difference between parents and children is different now, right? So I listen to chart music. My children listen to chart music, so I'd be humming Kylie, Badam Badam, or whatever it is. And,
tune.
And they'd be listening to it as well. That wasn't the case when I was growing up. My father listened to Perry Como and somebody else who I didn't know, or Richard Clayderman or something, and I was listening to cool music. Whereas adults now are wanting to be younger for longer, and children want to be older
quicker.
So the idea of that gap is getting less and less and less. And so when you want to be the cool parent, the device and giving them what they want is a phenomenally different thing. And I think sometimes being a parent is about being unpopular. You know, it's about taking the hard decisions. And I think that's become more difficult now than it was 20 years ago.
The boundary wall is kind of different and a bit
more. It's much more
lower
permeable
and transparent. Yeah.
And it's easier to scale, I think. Do you know what I mean? It's easier to hop over.
And I mean, you're going through it in your own household, as you said. Like, you've got one child who has the phone now and a younger child who really wants that phone. And that, like, I can, are you prepared to navigate this? This is going to be hard for you because you have to justify why one has it and why one can't have it yet and may not even get it at the same age, possibly.
Possibly. Yeah, it's difficult because it is about the want and need issue. And again, I think earning the right by showing the responsibility is part and parcel of that. So my tactic is, you know, start tight with all, you know, I have full access to my son's phone at any time. And if he steps out of line in any way, he will lose that access to that device. Do you know what I mean? So what I'm trying to teach him is, you know, you play ball, you get more. You're more responsible, more freedom. You know, that's the so I use the example of, you know, if your child wants to stay out till 10 o'clock at night over the summer holidays and you want them in at 8, what you say is, you come in at 8 3 days in a row on time, no arguments, no rows, I'll push it to 8:15. You come in at 8:15, no arguments, no rows, I'll push it to, and that's the process of starting low and moving as you go. But surveillance of technology is so difficult, and again, Snapchat being the challenging one from that point of view, because I can hear it going zzz every 5 minutes. Do you know what I mean? And like, he started first year, and the rule was no class groups. And like, before 3 o'clock, the staff group had been, or the kids group had been established. So from the point of view of you're trying to stem the tide of that influence is pointless. So I'm going to invest in my boy and try and get him to become as sensible with technology as possible. I don't know whether investing in the technology and trying to, and this might be something you might want to get into later, but the idea of, I think we rely very heavily on parent controlled apps, you know, and I always had this saying, you know, there's no app for your lap, you know, so teaching your child how to negotiate the world is not by, you know, it's not by not allowing them to go into places, it's about saying, you know, here's the thing. I think we try in the world at the moment to make a life as certain as possible. Right, so anxiety is a fear of the unknown, so we create as many certainties as possible. I think that's a mistake. I think we have to teach people to cope with uncertainty when it inevitably happens. You know, so the idea around how do you react to something that's going, so pornography, cyberbullying, if these things come his way, I'm not trying to say that spare him it, but if it did happen, what does he do? And, you know, one of the things I think I've said to him so many times is if you come to me with a problem, it doesn't mean I take your phone off you. You know, because I think the biggest issue is we say, I'm going to give you this against my better judgment. And then as soon as something goes wrong, they're expecting that I told you so, that's the phone gone, you know, and there's nothing worse than to be cut off from that world. So from the point of view of, I've tried to say to him many times, come to me, we'll deal with it. You know, it's not that it's automatically going to mean taking the technology away from you, because I think that unfortunately that silences a lot of children. And I've worked with lots of children who've hid stories about being bullied and picked on for months on the basis that the fear was, as soon as I tell my parents, the phone is gone. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I was going to say that that's most likely going to just get them to not tell anybody what's happening or the bad stuff.
And yeah, and I think we do it with the best of intentions as parents. You know, yeah. And I see parents going, if you're ever bullied, I'll be in there and I'll go into that schoolyard and I'll tell, you know, that's not the parent.
I just won't tell you then. Yeah, you know, that's the first thing that would come to mind.
Yeah, so the idea of, even though parents are doing that with the best of intentions, there might be ways in which we can empower them to enable them to speak more about the honesty of it, because it's not a world that they're going to negotiate without problems. You know what I mean? It's, let's be realistic. They will come across stuff, and even if they don't go looking for it, it'll find them. You know, and that's the approach. I'll keep you posted, but so far, 2 weeks in, it's going okay.
Well, that was great to hear from Coleman. And as well as the book, The 4-7 Zone, he wrote a book prior to that called Cop On, What It Is and Why Your Child Needs It to Thrive and Survive in Today's World.
I love that title.
Brilliant. And yeah, like, it really speaks to the kind of things that he was talking about with us today. So definitely do check that out if you're interested in more of his work. But basically, a lot of it is about opening the channels of communication with your kids about technology, looking at your own use of technology, and if you're being a good model there. It is a bit, you know, rich to be saying like, no, you can't have this because you can't behave yourself on it, and then you're misbehaving, yeah, on your social platform. So like, that's worth thinking about. But there is also space there, I do think, you know, for us to be looking at interventions maybe at school level and stuff like that. Like, I know in Finland they have like a world-renowned media literacy program for their kids, digital media literacy in particular. And they're doing it with a view of making sure that the kids leaving school and the school system in Finland are capable of parsing information that's shared online and telling disinformation and misinformation from genuine information. That's actually kind of one of their key goals in it. But in general, doing that kind of work and actually like putting a curriculum behind it and formalizing it and bringing it to all schools across the nation, like, that's just a really good thing to do, because it's like Coleman was saying, like, this tech is here, like, talking about like just trying to like block kids from it, like, they're gonna find workarounds. Let's be real here, they're going to be online. How do we help them to navigate that safely and in a healthy way? And like, we'll share a link in the show notes, but that Finnish program got a great write-up in the New York Times. The Guardian has written about it. Like, they're kind of setting the standard there.
It's so
cool,
important, I think, because like you said, it's here already. The content, like, we can talk about regulation all the live long day. The platforms can do all these things, be it tokenism, be it real action, but it's not going to stop everything forever. And there is a layer of, you can't block massive amounts of the internet from the world. So it's better that people are prepared. Like, if the resilience levels are at zero, they're never going to be able to prepare for something if they do come across it. So the literacy part is just so much more important.
And like, we can wring our hands all day about, think of the children, but like, it's all talk at the end of the day. Like, there was the US Surgeon General even came out with a statement not that long ago, basically warning against social media use for kids. And like, that US Surgeon General's warning is a trope that you see on like cigarette packets and stuff like that. But you know, it's kind of, that problem is, so yeah, you can actually create laws against selling cigarettes to kids, but that doesn't stop kids from smoking. They're gonna smoke if they're curious about smoking, and it's just kind of like how they're educated and how they learn to navigate peer pressure and all that side of it as well is actually as important as your, you know, taxation, your labels and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I think those lessons like go into real life anyway as well. Like they help them in real life as well as their online life, their physical life and their online life. But it's just so important. And also it comes into that other trope of like too much screen time that Coleman mentioned. That's just kind of arbitrary and nonsense because it is like the food analogy. I loved his food analogy. I just think it's great because it's not like the answer, as we all know, even though like plenty of parents still do it, I'm sure, but the answer is not no junk food ever for the rest of your life. Like you're not a single chip will pass your lips ever. No donuts, no ice cream, no sugar ever. Like that's not the real world.
Yeah. But just and that'd like, be very hard as a parent to enforce.
Absolutely.
Like your kid's going to go to a party and there's going to be sweets and they're supposed to decide themselves, no, I can't possibly have that Coke on though I really really want it.
Which is where you come into the idea of like not banning the phone flat out and not talking about technology and banning them from all social media. A, they'll find a way around, but even if they don't find a way around, they're going to be exposed to spaces where they have access to it. You can't follow your child to a party and make sure they never have a piece of chocolate, but you can tell them and help them learn and at least restrict as much as you can in them and help them understand what a balanced diet is. I have a fabulous friend who is a parent who like refuses to talk about good food and bad food or like you know, cheeky snacks or things like that. Like it's all just food. Like it's like no matter what it is, it's not like, you know, a little treat or anything. Like
or something's like a bad food or something like that. Yeah.
Or like a little like cheeky takeaway, anything like that. Like she's trying not to like attach like positive and negative words to different categories of food because it's all just food and it's all about more nutrition stuff. And I think that should be the same as an online diet.
Yeah, that's really interesting. But it is also like to think of like, you know, the signals that your kids are sending to you that maybe they're not a great self-regulator. Like some of that may come from other areas of their life. Like I'm just honestly just thinking of my nephew who will literally eat sweets until he is sick and then he will throw up and he'll go back and eat more sweets. Like God, I love him so much. But he's a silly little thing. And like, yeah, okay. So when it comes to sweets, he obviously doesn't have great self-regulatory capacities. Now he's a baby. So yeah. Like, I don't expect him to have that stuff. But yeah, it's like, yeah, if you're handing him the candy floss game,
yeah,
the equivalent of that, then maybe they're not going to be so good at switching that off unless like you can exert the same kind of control that you would if they were guzzling sweets until they were sick and you wanted them to stop.
Yeah. It doesn't mean that you're going to take sweets away from that child forever just because they can't self-regulate themselves yet. You're just like, okay, well, maybe I don't give you as much freedom with the sweets until you've shown me that you aren't going to eat them morning, noon, and night until you throw up over and over again. But it was also really interesting, you know, that idea of the research, the fact that like we're in a social experiment right now because there is no results and there is no kind of definitive stuff around it, because like there is some research being done. There's actually a researcher in Trinity College Dublin, Dr. Pablo Gracia, who secured a prestigious EU grant earlier this year to explore the links between digital use and social inequalities among adolescents. Now that's for teenagers, not for kids, but like that research is happening and I think it's really important to continue to look at that because, as Coleman said, like, you know, there are signals that are happening that we may or may not be paying attention to when like we're trying to fix the world and make sure that the kids are okay online.
So as much as the parents need to be communicating with the kids, well then, yeah, broader society, scientists and stuff like that, we also need to be getting feedback from the kids who've been part of this social experiment in a bigger way than even we have, because they're literally growing up online. Like judging by those stats from CyberSafe Kids, like they have a social profile from such an early stage of life. I can't fathom that. Like I can't relate to that the way, like I can't relay information on that the way they could. Like I couldn't get my head around it.
Yeah. It's impossible, I think, for parents at the moment to understand what it's like to be a 13-year-old with social media, because no parents, like very few or none really ever had that experience, because I think my first social media account was probably when I was 15, I think. And that was Bebo. You know, so
Bebo stunners.
Yeah, so that's not even there anymore. But it came with all that same dopamine stuff, the likes, the top 16s, the like whatever, sending your love a day or whatever the stuff was on Bebo. But it's all just social engineering that kids need to learn. So,
and let's not pretend that we had a clue what we were doing when we were navigating that stuff. So yeah, I suppose go forward with this generously with your kids. You know, none of us know what's going on, so talk to each other, learn from each other.
Yeah,
it'll be very healthy.
Hopefully you'll have gained some insights from two childless wagons.
Thank you for listening to this episode of For Tech's Sake, and thank you to Dr. Colman Nochter for sharing his expertise with us. You can find out more about Colman and his work at colmannochter.com, and we'll share some links to some of the other things we discussed in this episode in the show notes.
For Tech's Sake is a co-production from Silicon Republic and the Headstuff Podcast Network. Follow us at Silicon Republic and at For Tech's Sake Pod on your platform of choice. And please subscribe and share and let us know what you think.
Next week, we'll have a bonus episode featuring more from Colman, and this is exclusive for Headstuff Plus community members only. So do look into signing up, and otherwise, we'll be back to you in a fortnight.
This show is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
If you want to support this podcast and get a full ad-free episode, sign up to Headstuff Plus.